If our reading group was graphed, I would be the outlier on the graph. I'm a theological educator, and there were two of us who came out of the background of theology. To give you an idea of the effect that this has had on me every time I have gone back home to be with my faculty, they have said, stop hanging out with those people. We have no idea what you're talking about. And what I want to talk to you about is some of the applications of this. First, I'm going to talk about where I was this time last year. And one of the challenges of doing this is that the more I read, the more the ground keeps shifting, and the more I keep thinking, you know, if I focus my energy in that direction, it's not going to create the kind of dialogue with theologians that was one of the things I was interested in doing here. So at the end of last year, I was all excited about putting CSR into dialogue with a kind of somewhat obscure Canadian Jesuit thinking, a guy named Bernard Lonergan. And Lonergan was a theologian, a philosopher, and an economist, brilliant guy, who was really concerned about theology's inability to be able to find a common methodology that theologians could share. And he was jealous of the scientific method. So he thought if he could work on human consciousness, he might be able to figure out some kind of a common methodology that all theologians could share in, and we could at least begin to get kind of a benchmark of having a common ground somewhere. So I kind of designed this, you know, very attractive design here. And Lonergan was working in the 50s with what he referred to as depth psychology, which was really way before a lot of the kind of tools that now exist for being able to study how the human mind works and brain. So he came up really with five different conscious activities, consciousness operations. One was empirical, gathering data. The other was thinking about it. The intellectual of actually understanding the concepts, the rational of wrestling with it, the responsible of making a decision, and then love, which was at the core of consciousness, which, of course, God is love. And when he got to that point, which took him about, all told, three books and, I don't know, 1,900 pages to be able to get to it, he realized, I don't know anything about this. You have to go talk to people who are married or monks because they're the experts in love. And then he got very sick and he was not able to do any more with that. Moved to Toronto. I understand. I absolutely know a Jesuit. He developed a crush on Goldie Hawn at the end of his life, laughing. And a group of Jesuit scholastics, one who I knew, actually wrote to the show laughing to get a poster, which you can make a lot of money in Catholic circles if you could ever find that poster. Because it showed up, and I don't know what it had on there. Thanks for being a fan, Bernie, love Goldie, or whatever. But if he was alive, he would be very interested in CSR, if he hadn't run off with Goldie to marry her. The problem with this is I kept reading this past year, and the more I kept reading, the more I started realizing that if I wrote something like this, it would be great for my Vita, but I don't need anything on my Vita, and it wouldn't create much of a conversation. So I started rethinking for the third time exactly what to do with what I've learned over the past 2.5 years, and also to try to think in a way in which when I talk to my colleagues, they don't say, we don't know what you're talking about. And frankly, I can't do that without the help of the people who are researching CSR, what I'm going to do is talk a little bit about the problem of dialoguing from a theological and religious education perspective with CSR, talk about some of the impediments to the dialogue, and then make some suggestions on some research projects which may be impossible to do, but if you could do them, it would actually open up a window for being able to have a conversation. So to begin, we throw around the word, and the literature throws around the word, theology frequently. And religion. And it's used for a theologian, it's used in a way that it doesn't have anywhere near enough discrimination. So there's various ways of looking at religion from a theological perspective. All of them have different methodologies. All of them have different, the people that are involved in them have different type of characteristics that make them suited to what they're doing. And all of them actually could benefit from CSR, elements of CSR, if they could find a way to access the information. So I'm making a distinction between religious education and theological education, and this is applicable for most denominations, certainly within Christianity. Not all of them, but I think most. And you've really got a whole series of different types of ways of approaching what religion is about and trying to engage people. At the theological level, you really have, there should be four up there, undergraduate, academic graduate, practical theology, and religious studies. I come out of the practical theology. So my particular way of looking at religion is we're always asking the question, so what? Because this is an applied field. And it's the kind of theology that gives a master's of divinity degree or a doctorate of ministry degree, which is a practitioner. So it's similar to an MBA, probably more than anything else. And actually, I think all of these, all four of these have ways in which they can intersect with CSR, but fruitfully. Religious studies seems to be the one that's the most intrigued by this, the few that are interested. And that's a kind of a separate category, particularly from this. And I think the practitioners are where this information has to sometime, some way, somewhere begin to intersect. Because the more I've read, the more I've become aware that it's kind of like a food researcher only talking with people who cook at home and never paying a visit to Julia Child's or to master chefs. And it's a tricky thing because theologians are a quirky group, if you'll keep that private and don't say that I share that. But the field is really, it's got some unique pressure points, and it also looks at religion very differently than virtually everybody in this room. I mean, the way we look at it is closest to the philosophers, but even there, it's very, very different. So if you look at it this way, and I'll just run through a couple of these things, because this is just some of the profound possibilities for an interchange and a dialogue of information. So I'll just use HAT, which I see as a concept that you could address the capacity to discern spiritual experience. You can use it for an interpretive tool for making sense of early Christian experiences. The speculation on the process of how revelation actually came about. Rudolf Otto's Mysterium Tremendum et Fascinans, which is the whole experience of the sacred, and what does that actually, how does that play out within people's lives? In practical theology course, you spend a lot of time talking about that, because as a minister or a chaplain or somebody who's actually in pastoral ministry, you have to help people understand these had experiences that they're having. And in a religious study, in a religious education framework, you've got to be somewhat careful about this, because if you're seeing secret agents floating around everywhere, that works okay, and I don't have a problem with it theologically, at a certain age. So it was typical in Catholic households in the 60s to have first graders to try to teach them God's presence and protection. They would have them slide over in their seat to make room for their guardian angel. Now, this is with first graders. My wife named hers Angus. I think he had an image of some Braveheart character who was looking out over her. I don't have a problem with that, but theologically, as the person matures, you obviously have to start helping them question appropriately what those experiences are, what they mean, and what they're indicative of. So, everybody... Promiscuous teleological reasoning, a concept for addressing theological concepts like salvation history, vocation, the call of vocation. Almost everybody who ends up on our doors to become a student with us felt like they were called to come to that place, and they had all kinds of experiences that have led them in that direction. And part of our challenge is helping them discern, and then particularly with those who clearly don't have any kind of a call to this kind of work. Discernment of complicated situations, helping people in situations in which they're facing health, death issues, trying to interpret what that all means in their life and to negotiate through that. Deeply, deeply significant for my line of work in several areas of that. Maturational and practice naturalness, concept addressing the scope and sequence of religious education texts. That whole trajectory of moving from maturational to practice is contained in the scope and sequence of every religious education textbook. Why we're doing it the way we're doing it is predicated mostly on Piaget's thought and a few other people, but it's actually very dated research, and the people who are doing it, for the most part, don't know why they're doing it. They're completely detached from the theory of that they're applying. So, and as I'm sure you know, most religious educators are volunteers. Most of them are not theologically trained. They've had religious education. They have a limited grasp of the tradition. And that works, sort of, because what they're doing is something different than what theologians are doing. They're trying to help people access the faith tradition in the level of detail that they need to help them live a good and holy life. I mean, that's the intent of it. So the outcomes are actually quite different. Mentally counterintuitive concepts, identification of the concepts most difficult to understand within theology and religious education, critically different difficult problem. As you're trying to pace the cognitive load in a particular class, theologically it gets to be really, really complicated on how much heavy, really counterintuitive stuff students can handle without going into overload. If they're dealing with systematic theology, they're in overload for the whole semester or for the quarter, just in general anyway. So it gets really to be really complicated. This is also, though, I think is really critical for certain streams of theological education, but also ministerial preparation and actual ministry. Because this really this concept and the research that's been worked on it is actually really important for spiritual direction, for mentoring, which is key to theological education if you're going to be doing anything with it other than teaching it, and particularly for contextual education, in which case you go out to do ministry someplace, you end up taking what you've learned, put it in dialogue with who you are and what you've learned about yourself and what you're learning from the ministerial situation, and then you rethink your theology as a result of all that. So, and then non-reflective... Okay, so reflective and non-reflective beliefs, what Liz was talking about with meditation, contemplation, confession, holy conversation, what the Quakers, their clearness committees, are all things that the reflective, non-reflective beliefs, that's what you're really doing in those situations. You're attempting to try to pull out of the fast thinking, to pull it up into the conscious mind where you can actually look at it, think about it, critique it, change your theology. So... So doctrine and imagistic religiosity, cultural imprint on religious practice, the organizational structures flowing from theological beliefs and rituals, the role of tradition within the religious tradition, and then particularly, which is a big issue with almost everybody in theology, is religious identity, because we're moving into a hyphenated belonging period and a period in which what religious identity is no longer fits the template that most of us grew up with. And then lastly, theological correctness and incorrectness, generational and a cultural imprint of theological discourse. So I can send this to you if you guys are somehow interested in it. So I used this thing last year, but I had theology's pre-enlightenment inferiority complex, and I suggested that perhaps one of the reasons a dialogue hasn't happened is because theology, after the Enlightenment, lost its role as queen of the sciences, got a secondary position in the academy, and was still trying to deal with it, and so didn't want to get into the ring with a monster that was considerably bigger. As I've read over the past year, I think there's, in approaching this, a lot of CSR researchers actually are reflecting their pre-enlightenment inferiority complex by the way they're addressing theology. Because the theology they're addressing, oftentimes, is a theology I don't know. And I've been doing this for a pretty long time. So you got the four horsemen who are using some of this data, and they're misusing it often. I mean, in the God delusion, Justin is quoted, and kind of the way it's positioned, the way Dawkins positions it, it almost sounds like you agree with Dawkins. I mean, I don't know if you've seen that passage, but so what they're doing is they're actually taking the research, they're using it for their own ends, and it's actually... Theologians who are even familiar with this literature assume that CSR kind of comes out of this perspective, which they know is nonsense, just from a cursory look at it. In the paperback edition of Dawkins' God Delusion, he actually responds to something on his blog where somebody's asked him, "You don't seem to put whatever it is you're trying to say in dialogue with any serious theologians." And he mentions, like Paul Tillich, he mentions Jürgen Moltmann. And so what Dawkins ends up saying is, well, you know, there's such a minuscule amount. Most people who are religious are just not representative of the people that are out there. So they're just kind of like casually dismissed. Theologians, even with some of the more serious work, the visual of it from a theologian's perspective, if you look at the believing primate, the people who participated in that text, which I think was a very good one, you had 5 philosophers, 5 psychologists, 3 biologists, 1 sociologist, 1 physician, an anthropologist, a religious studies professor, and 1 theologian. So that constitutes, since you guys are all into numbers, that's 5% of the writers. So Nancy Murphy, who I think you're with, actually went back to the old theology as queen of the sciences and kind of the integrative discipline. I lost one of my slides here. The theologian was a guy named John Haight. He's a Jesuit. And John did exactly what I would expect most theologians to do encountering CSR research. He immediately got on a plane, flew up to 50,000 feet, and spent the whole time in his chapter talking about the faith-science debate. And knowledge is something, we're going after different types of knowledge, and we're separate from each other. So he didn't engage CSR research specifically and look at the theological implications of it at all. So let me look at you have the 4 horsemen, but you have more subtle things that kind of pop up. So Gervais and Norizayan, who we've heard from twice already, they make 2 references to theologians in the text. That I think this is your field for you who are psychologists, but this article got way more attention than it deserves. They make two references, Thomas Aquinas and Soren Kierkegaard. Kierkegaard's Fear and Trembling, Aquinas' Summa Theologica. Great books in the history of theology. One was written in the 13th century, the other was written in the 19th century. I mean, you would, in reading it as a theologian, you would think, oh, well, they don't think we've done any serious thinking since at least the 19th century. Here's Jason Sloan, who's a religious studies professor, I think, for my hometown. Which, to account for, and so here's what he's doing when he approaches it, though. To account for why people do what they do and think what they think, we're better off employing a scientific method because neither the insider's views nor folk psychology will work. Science proves to be much more useful because it reaches below the surface. Any theologian, particularly in my area of theology, would, if they read this, they would immediately stop reading at that particular point, and they would set it aside. Theological education has use of all kinds of ways of helping students get below the surface. It is the point in practical theology that you have to spend most of your time trying to do. So, and there's techniques for doing it. I mean, in my Catholic world, probably the most significant one is the spiritual exercises that Ignatius of Loyola created, the founder of the Jesuits. Incredibly psychologically sophisticated for the 16th century, been used for centuries to help people get below the surface in their own life, to find peace in their life, discern directions in their life, all kinds of things. So I think I know what he was trying to say, but from a theological perspective, what it would suggest to say that the scientific method is the arbiter of all claims to truth. And a theologian, on basic principle, would say, and we're not just talking about revelation here, we're talking about human experience, at least for many of traditions. So this is another article I read by Blanke and a number of other people, in which they make a reference to evolutionary theory, the way Catholics think about it. They quote John Paul II speaking to the Pontifical Academy of the Sciences about evolution, and then they kind of designate to him that he's trying, but he's caught in essentialist and teleological intuitions that kind of prevent him from being able to fully grasp the concept. Problem with that is, and I had my problems with John Paul with some things, but he was a continental philosopher who was very nuanced in his thought. To take a little snippet about evolutionary theory, ascribe it to the whole Catholic tradition, when the Catholic tradition has actually been dealing with it since an encyclical, Humani Generis, that was published in 1950, is a kind of a really crass characterization of somebody's thought. So all of this to say, theologians need some way of being able to engage the issues that they're actually dealing with. And so I'm just going to give you two quick quotes, and then I'll make some suggestions on maybe strategies. Many of you probably know Brian McLaren. And there was a book that he wrote, A Generous Orthodoxy. And when we think in terms of when you think in terms of religious concepts, we often think of them as being very static. And Larry, what you guys were trying to do, you're trying to do with static concepts. Well, you have McLaren writing A Generous Orthodoxy, where I am a missional plus evangelical plus post-Protestant plus liberal conservative plus mystical poet plus biblical charismatic contemplative fundamentalist Calvinist. These categories don't fit with one another. And yet the religious reality is that people are living within some kind of reality that's different than static conceptions of what that is. This one's even more complicated. A Catholic Hindu-Christian scholar, a guy named Panikkar. I left as a Christian, found myself a Hindu, and I returned as a Buddhist without ever having ceased to be a Christian. What does that mean? Well, as theologians, we're wrestling with what that means, and we don't know what it means either, but we know that people are experiencing it, and some of us have actually experienced it too. So, fishing project, we're trying to get theologians involved. There's three traditions that CSR can build on. One is by James Michael Lee, who focused on religious education. The other, and actually wrote a ton of stuff that very few people reacted to. He thought religious education was a social science, not a theological enterprise. Lawrence Kohlberg, who came up with a developmental moral, many of you probably know him, he ended up being integrated into a lot of religious education textbooks. A lot of theologians have been in dialogue with Kohlberg's ideas. And then lastly, James Fowler, who probably most religious education textbooks by large companies have somehow made use of Fowler's work. And I'm not so sure Fowler's work is as good as, or is as reliable as it's often presented. But so here's a suggested probe. That's the first one. Here's the second one. Theological correctness studied across different levels of practice, naturalness, I should say. Sorry, spell check. Those receiving identifiable dimensions of education, seasoned ministers, those trained in spiritual direction and theological reflection, particularly those who lead in complex, stressful pastoral situations. The idea behind this is that if you've had a really good theological education on this trajectory, what ends up happening to that intuition, that intuitive conceptual framework that you use of religious, do you revert back to it the way a lot of the people who've been studied in some of the studies that CSR has been doing? Or have you actually rethought your theology to a point that even under highly stressful situations, you actually now have that practiced naturalness? I would submit that we do, and I could list a whole bunch of people as examples of that. Here's another one, and then I got one more. Mapping onto theological theory with CSR's relevance, there's two ways of carving up what the church is and how it operates in the world that I think there's a lot of relevance, and it's pretty commonly known by theologians. One is Reinhold Niebuhr's Christ and Culture, in which he looked at five models of the church through history that are very different from one another. The other is Avery Dulles' models of the church, which actually looked at five different models of the way churches operate internally and emphasize certain parts of the Christian tradition. And then lastly, and this one is something that it becomes more apparent to me every time I come, because we keep making reference to Reformed epistemology. So I don't know how much CSR researchers have got into dialogue with a Catholic epistemology, which, you know, I talked about last time. For Catholic with a small c, the Second World War was a game changer for everybody. What happened with the death camps? Everybody started thinking about theology from an experiential way. Some theologians refer to it as an anthropological turn in the way we do theology. So doctrinal and imagistic transmission principles operate simultaneously within this kind of a structure. There's a both-or orientation rather than an either-or. There's a heavy orientation of integrating maturational and practice naturalness, by that spell check, as much as by intuition as by conscious choice. So this is kind of a different way of looking at religion, which, frankly, it seems to me actually has a lot more possibility of really fruitful dialogue, because it gets into the experience, which is the mental operations that CSR is trying to track. Actually, it's closer to the action, I guess, in a way, I would say. So that's all I've got. I can leave on this.